Case number 20-1313 et al. City and County of San Francisco Petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Ms. Mapes for the petitioner, Mr. Ettinger for the respondent, Ms. Ward for the intervener.
We'll just wait to begin until the court clears and counsel for the next case come in. Good morning, counsel. Ms. Mapes, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, your honors, and may it please the court. We're here to talk about a practice that PG&E has imposed under its wholesale distribution tariff, under which it denies secondary service for all but the smallest of loads. That secondary service allows loads to connect at a lower voltage level without expensive primary facilities that could cost hundreds of thousands of dollars more. If it's too expensive or if it's physically impossible for San Francisco to install those primary facilities, San Francisco loses the customer. It becomes a PG&E retail customer. PG&E then serves those facilities using the same secondary facilities it would not allow San Francisco to use to serve the customer. FERC should have rejected this practice as the anti-competitive pretext that it is. Instead, it rubber stamped it. In doing so, it did not make a single finding that the medium size or small loads discussed here interconnected to secondary threaten the reliability of the grid. It did not address a single operational argument made by PG&E or San Francisco's rebuttals to that argument. It did not even explain why PG&E can serve its own loads of that size as secondary, why it can serve previously connected San Francisco loads as secondary, why it can serve loads belonging to other wholesale distribution customers as secondary.
The agency did submit an affidavit or declaration that talked about safety and reliability. And I understand your point that, at least I haven't found in the record a place where the agency said, for example, San Francisco requests X, but if you look at X, which PG&E denied for secondary service, there are safety problems in that 1, 2, 3, 4, and there are reliability problems 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's not there. But what is the burden here? Because FERC's orders describe the system. It describes the relationship that's been going on for many years. And now it also says that it's not as though there's an actual policy, because sometimes San Francisco's requests have been approved. So what measure of specificity is required here?
Your Honor, I have a couple of answers to that. The first is that under the Federal Power Act, FERC's decisions need to be supported by substantial evidence.
That's more than a scintilla, all right? So that's why I want to know.
That's correct. However,
Your Honor, though the agency didn't describe a system, it described, in terms of argued just this morning, it's self-evident. This is a complex system, involves many interconnections. PG&E has to make these determinations. It has made these determinations and said why, but it hasn't said in this particular example, we didn't think the safety was adequate.
Your Honor, I think there's a number of things in the record that make FERC's rather conclusory determination that PG&E should have total discretion, not supported by substantial evidence. The first is that, as you noted, FERC found that PG&E does not have a policy of denying these loads. It grants them in some situations. That is actually flatly contradicted by the record. The record shows, and PG&E readily conceded in its brief, that in July of 2019, PG&E informed San Francisco that, well, in the past, it had granted a few accommodations for loads above 75 kilowatts. It was no longer going to do that going forward. That is in Joint Appendix 284 and you can see PG&E.
That's not what the commission was reviewing in the decisions that we're considering, right? That's a prospective determination that still, as I understand it, that still hasn't been finally resolved because it's pending. It's pending now.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. It is true that after the commission issued its decision in this case, PG&E then filed a new tariff stating that it would not grant secondary service at all. However, the July 2019 letter was before the commission in this case. It was under the previous version of the wholesale distribution tariff that was before the commission, and the commission did not address that in its order. There's actually another part of that that the commission failed to address, which is that if you look at the charts that both, well, that FERC, the PG&E included in it, below FERC, and that FERC included in its brief here, FERC uses those charts as evidence to show that PG&E was granting secondary service on a regular basis. San Francisco alleged in its complaint that PG&E began this practice in late 2017, I believe November of 2017. Most of the instances where loads over 75 kilowatts were connected, shown in those charts, are in 2015 or 2016. There's a few in 2017, and there's only three in 2018. Because FERC didn't set this case for hearing, the record is not as developed as it might otherwise have been. But I think of the very few secondary in 2018, many of them might have been in process before 2017. So San Francisco filed this complaint relatively soon after PG&E began this new practice. FERC did not set it for hearing, and PG&E became more definitive about its practice as the briefing was ongoing at FERC. It was clear that as of July 2019, PG&E would not accept any more requests for secondary service above 75 kilowatts. The other thing I would say about that is that the tariff actually has a definitive process to ensure that the safety and reliability of the system are maintained. If you look at the tariff itself, it has a process by which San Francisco or any wholesale distribution customer submits an application. PG&E then has an obligation to do what is called a system impact study at the customer's expense to determine whether that interconnection can be undertaken safely. If it cannot, PG&E has the obligation to use due diligence to expand or modify its distribution system to provide the requested service. The distribution system in the tariff is explicitly defined to include the secondary system. PG&E has not been doing that, and it has stated so in the record. When it receives a request for secondary service above 75 kilowatts, its practice as of 2017 has been to deny it and to tell San Francisco to submit a new application for primary service. It does not perform the required system impact study. So there were a few cases in which San Francisco was able to go through a lengthy negotiations process with PG&E to resolve the issue, but it was not receiving proper service under the tariff.
Ms. Mate, the tariff, am I right that the tariff itself is silent on where PG&E has to provide primary and secondary service, right?
It is, Your Honor, as to which voltage levels.
Yeah, so in that case, don't we have to defer to the commission's interpretation?
Your Honor, I would say that the commission is entitled to deference as to its interpretation of the tariff.
Yeah.
I would also say that because the commission disregarded the process the tariff lays out, the system impact study process, the obligation to expand and modify its distribution system, it does not pass the arbitrary and capricious test, and even with deference, its interpretation fails. San Francisco is not, as FERC seems to be stating that it gets total discretion over which voltage levels can be interconnected. It wants the tariff process to be followed.
And what do you do with the commission's statement that in utility interconnections, when you're talking about utility to utility interconnections, that primary service is the norm in the industry?
Your Honor, I would state that that's misleading. That's misleading. Uh-huh. And in fact, I think we use sloppy language in one of our briefs as well, and I apologize for that. Utility to utility interconnections are normally at higher voltage. In most cases, I believe, that would be at transmission level voltages. where you would have, say, PG&E interconnecting with its southern neighbor, Southern California Edison.
That's even higher than primary.
That's even higher. Uh-huh. So the kind of situation where we have here, where San Francisco's loads are dispersed within PG&E's service territory, is relatively unusual. It is not unheard of. There are other wholesale distribution customers, particularly the Western Area Power Administration, that has a very similar setup and which does receive secondary service.
I didn't read you to be taking issue with the premise that, putting aside the situations in which it's even higher than primary, that primary would be the normal mode for utility to utility. I didn't read your briefs to be taking issue with that.
I don't think we would. I think we fully admitted this is a relatively unusual situation. And, you know, I would also say that even if we took primary service at all these circumstances, it would still be an unusual situation. The interconnection is just not the normal one.
Council, you're welcome to continue or to reserve your time for rebuttal, whichever you prefer.
Well, I would make one more point, which is that I think it is worth talking about the Western Area Power Administration for a minute. That is another wholesale distribution customer that is similarly situated to PG or to San Francisco.
Who are you talking about?
It is the Western Area.
Oh, okay. Now I know. I just didn't hear you. Yeah,
that's what the
Western Area. Okay, fine.
Yeah, the one that have a settlement agreement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they have a settlement agreement with PG&E. I think they do take service under the same wholesale distribution tariff. That settlement agreement is pursuant to the same wholesale distribution tariff and enables them to take service under it. Like San Francisco, Western has many small points of interconnection scattered throughout the area in which they operate. In San Francisco's case, that's more constrained within the city. In Western's case, it's more spread out in Northern California. PG&E allows the Western Area Power Administration to add these new secondary points of delivery. It has not pointed to any physical or operational or technical differences between them. As far as we are aware, as in the record, none exist. The fact that Western receives this service pursuant to a settlement does not allow, under this court's precedent, FERC to claim that entirely insulates it from undue discrimination. This is open access service. Every customer under this tariff should receive comparable service if they're similarly situated, and that is not something that has happened to date. And if there are no further questions, I can reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Mapes. We'll hear from the commission now. Mr. Attiger.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Scott Ettinger for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and thank you for hearing the case today. There are just a few points I would like to make in response to the arguments by San Francisco. And I do want to begin by emphasizing the point that the commission has made throughout the orders, challenged orders, is that the normal norm for interconnection from utility to utility is to connect at primary. And it truly is something exceptional that San Francisco is asking for here. And again, as we were just discussing, the only other arrangement of an eligible customer under this tariff is with the Western Power Administration. And I want to go straight to that. The commission addressed the settlement that
but that may be the norm, but This all goes back to this Hetch Hetchy arrangement where Congress, the whole thing was designed, as I understand it, to let San Francisco compete, right, with providers like utilities like PG&E. It's a different, because of this history, it's not your normal utility-utility connection. Isn't that right?
This is indeed.
And if you look at what FERC, what PG&E has done in both of these cases, with its narrow interpretation of the grandfathering clause and with its limiting of secondary service, it's basically eviscerated or greatly limited the ability of San Francisco to compete, which was the purpose of this whole Hetch Hetchy project 100 years ago, wasn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think San Francisco still can compete, and it just has to follow. I think what the commission is saying here is San Francisco has to follow the industry norm.
Well, in other words, it can't compete the way it used to, right?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay, and isn't that a pretty strong argument for suggesting that the utility to utility practices just don't apply in this case? We have a different situation here.
I would respond to that. It is an unusual situation, but I would respond to that by taking the next point from the industry norm is the next point is that there's actual practical explanation for why this is the industry norm. And while this is an unusual situation, those practical matters still apply here. And the commission addressed this in the initial order, what we call the 2020 order, at paragraph 38. This is at JA 363, where the commission made the finding that primary facilities are necessary for the safe and reliable operation of the system. And I would also reference the court to paragraph 22 of that same order. This is at JA 357. The commission there described a little more about PG&E's rationale and explanation.
Let me just interrupt you. I have a couple questions. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you've raised a couple of issues. You just said that, you know, PG&E is responsible for the safety and reliability of the system, right? And so, I didn't see any place in the record where FERC addressed whether or not the voltage level related to safety. Where did it do that? Where did FERC say that the above 75 creates a safety or reliability problem, but below 75 doesn't?
The link is to the facilities that...
To the what?
The link is to the facilities. And what the commission is saying is that primary facilities achieve the safety and reliability benefits.
Yeah, but that's the conclusion.
That is a conclusion.
This is an APA case, right?
Yes.
So FERC's decision has to respond to the arguments that are made by San Francisco here. And one of their arguments is that FERC hasn't demonstrated that there's a relationship between safety and these particular levels. They say that under 13.4, PG&E has to exercise due diligence to expand its distribution system to provide secondary services whenever they ask for it. Now, they may be right or wrong about that, but they say there's nowhere in the record where FERC responded to that. But their point is they've made arguments about PG&E's responsibility to respond to their request for secondary service. They've made arguments that there's no rational connection between the particular levels that PG&E has picked here, and their argument is that FERC didn't respond to any of it, which is kind of classic APA, isn't it?
The commission did respond to the service argument, and that's leads the commission's analysis.
What do you mean by this? You mean the first or the second points I made?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't.
The first or the second point? Which did FERC respond to?
The commission made the finding that PG&E has not denied service to San Francisco. And in support of that, I would point the court to section 215 of the tariff. And this is in the joint appendix in the other case, the 2000.
What about the letter that Ms. May mentioned?
Which letter?
The letter where PG&E, she says, yes, they were providing service on a case-to-case basis, but there's a letter dated...
2019?
Yeah, the July letter, which says we're not going to do it anymore. And FERC didn't respond to that either.
The commission did make the finding in a couple places in that the rehearing order, paragraph 10, note 27, this is at JA 15, that some of the examples that we cite in our brief had occurred after 2017. And I'll also point out that PG&E filed this information in, I believe the information went up through 2018, and PG&E filed it in May. So it provided the most up-to-date information, mm-hmm. and that's the information that we relied on in our brief. And I think it demonstrates a couple of things, that of the interconnections that have been made since San Francisco started taking service under the 2015, over 40% have been for greater than 75 kilowatts, and a majority of those have been at secondary service. So it just doesn't, it's not the case that PG&E has been denying service to San Francisco under the tariff.
Can I ask a question about the, although I don't want to cut off Judge Tatel if,
go for it.
I have a question about the filed rate doctrine and its yes. applicability here. So as I understand the commission's understanding of the filed rate doctrine, if there were an unwritten policy to the effect that for loads larger than 75 kilowatts, the service is going to be primary service. That's not anywhere spelled out in the tariff, obviously. But if that were the policy that PG&E were implementing, then it would be inconsistent with the filed rate doctrine not to have that policy in the terms of the tariff.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And I think that's what the commission was getting at.
Right. So then the question becomes, yeah, I think that is what the commission was getting at paragraph 12 on JA 416 to 417 as I read that. And so then the question becomes, if that would need to be in the tariff, then if there's a policy that that's just the default assumption, as opposed to an inexorable rule, it's a default assumption that if it's above 75 kilowatts, the service is going to be primary, but we can have a negotiation to figure out whether we're actually going to allow secondary service. And why doesn't that also need to be in the tariff? What's the difference between an ironclad rule and a default assumption for purposes of the filed rate doctrine?
For the filed rate doctrine, I would refer the court to the rule of reason here. This is what Your Honor is suggesting is it would be a very difficult rule to codify in the tariff. And what the commission has found here is that PG&E has actually been flexible in its application.
But I don't know what's difficult about the default assumption. I mean, it may be that what's difficult is what happens to try to controvert the assumption. But in terms of the existence of the assumption to begin with, it seems like a pretty straightforward specified rule, which is that the default assumption, unless, let me put it this way, if there's no further submissions by the city, then service is going to be primary if the load is over 75 kilowatts. Not inexorable, because there could be some other stuff. And I might agree with you that as to the other stuff, that's not reducible to the level of specificity that would implicate the filed rate doctrine. But in terms of the existence of the assumption in the first place, because it's tethered to a particular level, 75 kilowatts, and it just implements an assumption. I don't know enough about the, and I'm not suggesting that I know the answer. I don't know enough about the filed rate doctrine to understand why there would be a distinction between a rule, an inexorable rule that would have to be in the tariff, and a default assumption that's equally specific as to 75 kilowatts, but for some reason that doesn't have to be in it.
At the end of the day, I think in both cases, whether the assumption is in the tariff or whether it's not, at the end of the day, this is something that PG&E was flexibly working with San Francisco. And I guess it just, my answer would be that it wouldn't matter because what really matters is the particular facts of the case. And these are the things that we couldn't codify easily in the tariff. And I think under the rule of reason, the commission was right not to demand that codification. And the commission referred to some of these things in paragraph 43 of the 2020 order. This is JA 366. Mm-hmm. It talked about load size, location, and other factors. There's also references in the record, when a request is made too far from the facilities, that secondary voltage isn't sufficient to serve that.
Here you have San Francisco. It's not all spread out. And then the other comment was, well, some of the parts are not numbered, so it's difficult for inspectors to inspect and report. I mean, that's just, so put some numbers on. You know, it seems to be the obvious response there. And then if there is some part of northern San Francisco that's too far, FERC can say that, but it hasn't said that, has it, as to particular requests? And now we have this letter. And I know your point about you're just going to 2017. These options aren't available. So do you understand that to mean that even if you're in settlement negotiations, FERC would not be able to agree?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I follow the question.
We're all having problems getting our questions across, all right? Your position, as I understand it, is PGE is willing to negotiate on a case-by-case basis. And it put that chart out, and the agency put it in its opinion. But then San Francisco comes back and it talks about what's really happening on the ground. And I don't see where the response to that exists in the order. I mean, it talks about factors, et cetera. It talks about an industry preference, but San Francisco, and I don't see PGE saying we're different for all these reasons about all these multiple interconnections. And a lot of them are high voltage areas. In other words, if you read the record, it looks like there is a settled position.
Well, I'd respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. And I think our charts support what the findings of the commission were. The commission made the specific finding that the interconnections had continued, and
But you would agree, wouldn't you, that all of San Francisco's requests are not in remote areas, and that all of San Francisco's requests, if they involve units of the system that are not marked, they can be marked.
Yes, Your Honor. In addition to the point about the markings of the facilities, the PG&E also, and the commission talks about this in paragraph 22, this is at J357. And there, the commission cites PG&E's answer at page 17, and also the previous paragraph 21, and further references to the answer and the declaration of PG&E's expert.
Okay, but we've been through that, haven't we? These are general statements. They're not specific to particular requests by San Francisco. And furthermore, do you agree that PG&E is not following the tariff provision?
No, I don't agree with that. I believe what the tariff says is that PG&E must provide service, and service is defined in section 215 of the tariff. And this is in the JA on the other case, JA 370.
Well, take Judge Tatel's questions as framing the question, okay? And you can put San Francisco out of business, basically. I understand that, because it doesn't say PGA has to provide the service that's requested. But doesn't it have to say why you can't have it, particularly since there are these provisions of the tariff that talk about expanding facilities and also having a study done at San Francisco's cost?
That's right, Your Honor. There is a provision in the tariff for expanding the system, and that's at 13.4 of the tariff. There are two problems with that. First of all, that section refers to denial of service under the tariff. And then I would refer the court back to the definition of what is service under the tariff. And that's section 215.
So
and
your position is it's anything PG&E says it is, right? So what do you do with the other provision then that says that there's supposed to be this study at San Francisco's expense?
I would point out that furthermore in that section, there's a reference to good utility practice. And that gets us back to where we started with this, is that the arrangement between to provide utility to utility service at secondary voltage is entirely novel and entirely.
Well, it's not, counsel, on this record, because we know that settlements are entered. We also know that some of PGE's customers, own customers, are receiving secondary service. So, you know, that's just not a viable argument, is it?
So a couple things in response to that. First of all, with respect to the one other eligible customer that's receiving secondary voltage, that is by settlement, and the commission discussed that in its order.
It says it's under section 210 and 211. We're under 206. Yes. Therefore, what? The tariff still applies in all those cases.
Well, what the commission was saying in paragraph 42 of the initial order was that the arrangement with Western is a bargain for arrangement that resulted from a settlement. And
my point, counsel, is that I'm not contesting that that is what happened, but the fact that PGE agreed suggests that maybe the fact these utilities aren't marked, maybe the fact that there don't seem to be any safety problems, it would be an unusual situation, would it not, for PG&E to agree to such a settlement if it forced it to violate good utility practice and everything else.
I think that's right, Your Honor, but I think that's only part of the equation. The import of the bargain for agreement is that there was a trade-off. And PG&E, I would submit, made a determination in the settlement that allowed for it to accommodate this unusual circumstance for Western.
And so you acknowledge at the beginning that San Francisco presents an unusual circumstance. It's not the typical.
Yes.
All right. So I don't know where these arguments get us. Doesn't the agency have to be more specific?
The agency was specific here, I would submit, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. I can.
You can answer that question, and I know that Judge Tatel has another question as well.
I would just refer the court again to the norm that the commission found here, and the unusual circumstance of connecting at secondary for the utility to utility connection, and I would refer the court as well to paragraph 38 of the initial order, which fleshed this out in addition to its summary of PG&E's arguments at paragraphs 21 and 22.
Mr. Edinger, I've spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out the relationship between this case and the next case. And since you're arguing that, I think that's a fair question for me to ask you this question, which is that, and I want to emphasize, this is totally hypothetical question. But if I think FERC is wrong in the grandfather case, if I think it's wrong, and that decision has to be vacated, will all grandfathered facilities continue to get secondary service? In other words, is this case just about non-grandfathered customers? Do I have that right or not?
This case is, in the case of grandfathering, the San Francisco, so the other case, San Francisco does not own facilities for those delivery.
No, but if FERC is wrong about that, and what governs is 212F. In other words, I don't want to get into that argument because we'll do that in the next 10 minutes or 5 minutes. I just want to know that if you lose that case, is this case only about non-grandfathered or am I missing something?
I think going forward, Your Honor, that there would, if I understand San Francisco's argument in the other case, is they're advocating for a much broader class of grandfathering going forward. So they would argue, and if the commission were to lose that case, there would be a broader class of facilities that...
So the answer to my question is yes, right? Grandfathered facilities will get, however broadly you define it, narrow or broad, if you divide it broadly, as San Francisco does, grandfathered facilities will get secondary service, right? So this case... either way, is only about ungrandfathered, right?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, if my colleagues don't have additional questions for you, Mr. Ettinger, we'll hear from PG&E Council. Ms. Ward.
May it please the court. My name is Alexandra Ward on behalf of the intervener for the respondent, PG&E. First, I'd like to address questions about the system impact study. The system impact study process was not raised by San Francisco. So their failure to raise this argument means it cannot be presented to this court. But for further background on how a system impact study works, it comes after the initial review. PG&E reviews the application. There's nothing in this record that speaks to whether or not PG&E disregarded its system impact study practices. Next, I'd like to address the operating numbers question by Judge Rogers.
Can I just be clear then? Before PG&E knows what the system impact study would show, it rules on the request?
Your Honor,
request on the broad statement of concerns about safety and reliability?
Before, when PG&E receives an application, we conduct an initial review and determine whether or not there's capacity.
The answer to my question, yes.
Can you please repeat your question, Your Honor?
My question is, as I understand what you're telling me, PG&E interprets the tariff to mean that it can consider a request, deny it on concerns generally about safety and integrity and reliability, without knowing what the system impact study would show as to any of those factors?
The answer is no, Your Honor. PG&E would not just deny a request. What PG&E looks for in an application is whether all of the information is complete on how the connection and how you would connect at that point of interconnection. And then
my hypothetical is it's a complete application down to the very last attachment. Every statement is complete and accurate. But the utility says we have no obligation to ask the requesting party to conduct this study because our concern about safety and reliability convinces us we should not grant it.
No, Your Honor, what PG&E would do is decide, okay, this request means that you need a primary interconnection and let's study the primary interconnection. So it's a matter of studying the details of the best point of interconnection.
Counsel, do you understand what I'm getting at? San Francisco has said, A, it has limited space. B, if it's not given the secondary, it's got to spend all this money on these facilities, money it doesn't have. And no one wants to know what the system impact might be. And given that PG&E is a provider, and so it has this overview, et cetera, of the system as a whole, it doesn't need to know the details. In other words, this tariff provision, which appears to be there for a purpose of informing the utility, and maybe the utility would simply say, well, we don't need any provider. But that's not what you're saying they say. They just don't need to ask for it at all.
San Francisco.
And they would only ask for it if they say, well, we're not sure, so we want to get this study.
If San Francisco would like to interconnect a point, has an application submitted to PG&E, PG&E will review the application and, per the terms of the tariff, conduct a system impact study if necessary.
PG&E does it at its own cost?
PG&E does it at San Francisco's cost, Your Honor.
Now, as I understand San Francisco, it's not asking for these studies.
Your Honor, I think this case really does not come down to the particulars of system impact studies, and there's really not enough in the record to discuss how PG&E conducts its system impact studies. What's really at issue is the fact that San Francisco wants to continue to receive the type of service that it previously received under its old expired agreement, when it didn't have to own any of its own facilities. And it depended on.
I understand it. The utility's point is we're concerned about safety and reliability of the system as a whole. Furthermore, some of these areas may be remote. Furthermore, the individual units are not marked. What more has the utility provided?
Your Honor, I believe that the record has evidence about the engineering rationale behind why primary interconnections.
Well, I've read the declaration. It's very general. He doesn't believe it's good practice.
Yes, and beyond that, the operating numbers, which you've asked about earlier, there are no operating numbers at the secondary voltage level. And so
the only way you put them on? That's what I don't understand.
According to my
PG&E didn't say it's impossible for us to add these numbers.
It's standard utility practice, Your Honor, in which only primary facilities receive operating numbers. And the switch logs are focused on primary interconnections. And so it gives the direction.
Standard operating procedure. We're under a tariff. This is a situation of a request by a requesting party that is not the usual type of request. I'm just trying to understand what we're dealing with here. Otherwise, it looks like there is this unwritten policy.
Your Honor, the use of the operating numbers practice of having a switch log, that all goes to why it's important for PG&E as the service provider to have discretion when looking at each application on a case-by-case basis on whether.
I don't think that's an issue, all right? Candidly, FERC has agreed to that. And that's not what the court's questions have been addressing. I think I understand your position.
Can I, I'm sorry, were you done, Judge Rogers?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Judge Tatel.
Can I just pursue this operating number thing? Maybe you could just explain that to me. As I understand it, secondary connections don't have operating numbers, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And so what's a switch log?
So a switch log is, that's the directions that the utility has on how to operate the system. So an example would be if San Francisco has a police station that's interconnected, and PG&E needs to go out there and for purposes of maintenance or if there's an emergency, we can read the switch log and all the operating numbers. We have a clear guide, and there's a distinction that the ownership stopped at the meter panel. But it's after that point in which, and that's why there's the importance of having clarity in the system and a distinct division, is because if the end user, the police station, is taking service from San Francisco, the secondary system does not allow for a clear understanding of whose materials are whose.
Okay, so I see. So I hope I understand this enough to ask this question, but why doesn't that problem, that same problem, that is the absence of operating numbers, apply to all of the other customers PG&E serves at the secondary level, like, for example, the 96% of San Francisco customers, PG&E's own retail customers, and the Western Area Power Administration? How come it doesn't? They all get secondary service. Why hasn't the absence of operating numbers been a problem for them?
Well, the difference, Your Honor, for PG&E's retail customers is that we understand where the ownership stops, and then it's our retail customer.
Okay. Afterwards. What about the 96%?
For the previously interconnected, the 96% of interconnections that are at secondary, Your Honor, those were connected at a time in which, under the 1987 interconnection agreement, where we treated San Francisco like a retail customer, which it is not. And so now, good utility practice and looking forward, which is why we're ending, this is in our brief that we are currently stating that we will no longer offer primary service. And when the settlement agreements end with Western, we will no longer offer primary or secondary to them.
I think that's just circular. You said it's not been a problem in the past for primary service, but now we're not going to offer it anymore. Why can't PG&E just assign operating numbers to secondary service?
Sorry, can you speak up, Your Honor, just a little bit?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Why can't PG&E just assign operating numbers to customers getting secondary service?
Your Honor, from my understanding is that secondary equipment does not include operating numbers, and the operating numbers are only applied at primary.
That's not in the record, by the way, is it?
That is correct. That's just from my understanding, speaking with our engineers.
Yeah, when I read this, I wondered. My first reaction to this, when I saw your argument about it, I looked in the record to see what the explanation was for why you couldn't just assign operating numbers. And FERC didn't even ask that question, did it? FERC didn't address this at all, right?
Your Honor, I would say that FERC, as the agency that understands the system, has technical expertise, understands that interconnections at primary are the utility, the preference for utility to utility interconnections. And that, although might not, why there you can't add it to secondary might not be in the record, is something that FERC FERC could have understood with their expertise when making that determination.
Well, too bad they didn't let the court know. I guess my point is, I can understand if I own a piece of equipment, I don't want PG&E coming in and putting numbers all over it. All right, but PG&E can say, well, we're not going to provide service unless we can put numbers so that we can identify the equipment. And therefore, when we get a call from the police station saying there's a fire or something's not working, we'll know what piece of equipment to look at because our service logs will identify it. I mean, that's a problem that PG&E has appears to be of its own making. That's all I'm getting at. And maybe there's a good explanation, but it's not in the record.
Your Honor, I would say it's really about the utility-to-utility relationship that's most important. It's the police station, in your example, shouldn't be calling PG&E. They should be calling San Francisco as their provider.
So the call comes in from San Francisco saying we've got a problem at the police station. PG&E says, well, we have no idea where it's located because those facilities are not marked. I mean, counsel, this is not rocket science. That's all I'm getting at. Anything further?
I have one more question.
Yeah, Judge Tatel. We had a debate, a little bit of a debate with counsel for San Francisco and FERC about this July 2019 letter from PG&E and its role in this. Do you want to say something about that? Can you help us understand what role that letter played and whether FERC is right that whether, I mean, FERC says in its decision that PG&E had no written or unwritten policy of denying service interconnection serving more than 75 kilowatts. But this letter seems to suggest the opposite, doesn't it?
Your Honor, when I read the letter, I don't think that it explicitly states that moving forward from that date on that we are no longer providing service, secondary service for loads above 75 kW. Mr. Hallemichael's declaration says and what's PG&E's practice is that when CCSF applies for an interconnection and requests secondary service, that PG&E looks at the existing distribution infrastructure in the vicinity of the service request to determine whether there'll be sufficient existing capacity to serve CCSF's load at secondary. So it is PG&E's practice, and there have been connections beyond the letter in 2018. I think that's most important to note if you were to look at filings at FERC, that there have been connections at secondary loads above 75 kW.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ward. Well, Ms. Mapes, you have, I believe you had 7 minutes left in your argument. Use for rebuttal if you'd like.
Thank you. I have a few points I'd like to clarify if I can. The first is I want to address what Ms. Ward just referenced, which was Mr. Hallemichael's declaration, where, and you can find this, I believe, at JA 172. And unfortunately, FERC and PG&E have been quoting one sentence of that declaration, where he does say that if they receive a request for secondary service, they evaluate the capacity on the system. If you continue on to the next sentence, he says that if that request is for 75 kilowatts or above, they will deny it. I would also say that we did address the process for connecting loads under the tariff in our initial brief. Unfortunately, I don't have the JA site, but that was pages 53 and 54 of our brief. So that is not a new argument. And there was one other point I wanted to make a correction on. Judge Tatel, in response to your question about the relationship between this case and the grandfathering case, I would differ with FERC counsel. The primary and secondary facilities at issue here are different than the intervening facilities. So if you look at section 14.2 of the tariff, you'll see a chart showing the facilities, intervening facilities needed for primary interconnections and the intervening facilities needed for secondary interconnections. So San Francisco does actually at many points own intervening facilities at primary and at secondary. Those are different sets of facilities. Even if we win in the 212H case, if we lose in this case, PG&E would continue to say that we cannot connect even grandfathered loads above 75 kilowatts to the secondary
that's
system.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. Great. More broadly, I wanted to talk a little bit.
I just ask you to repeat the JA site.
Yes, Your Honor. That Hallemichael declaration was JA.
The intervening facilities showing the difference.
Oh, that was the tariff section 14.2. And I apologize, I don't have that JA site.
Oh, I thought you had a listing. No, I've got 14.2. I thought there was an actual listing. All right, thank you, counsel.
I believe it might be there's a chart. It's further down in 14.2. There's a chart showing the intervening facilities for different kinds of interconnections, because it also includes.
Thank you. Right, thank you.
More broadly, I wanted to talk about the relationship of this case to FERC's open access policies, because we've been hearing a lot about, well, PG&E might deny San Francisco's requested interconnection and then negotiate with San Francisco, or PG&E negotiated with Western, or, well, they got that under the old bilateral tariff. PG&E transitioned to service under this open access tariff to San Francisco in 2015. FERC has been very clear that part of the reason it enacted its open access reforms in Order 888 was to remedy the kind of discrimination it found in bilateral agreements under the old system. And frankly, it called PG&E out explicitly in Order 88 as an example of a utility that was creating that kind of discrimination in bilateral agreements, requiring San Francisco to go through a lengthy negotiation for each routine city pool or library that it wants to connect to PG&E's secondary system is more or less the epitome of undue discrimination. It is not open access to PG&E's distribution system, which is what is provided for in its wholesale distribution tariff. And moreover, the July 2019 letter actually says that PG&E won't do that anymore.
Can you just point me to where that is, July 2019 letter?
Where that is? Yeah. I left that over here. The July 2019 letter is at JA 284.
Okay.
And it's discussed in, I believe, PG&E's pleadings at JA 158 and JA 172. And what that says is that PG&E will not continue granting accommodations unless essentially the entire case is settled or the resolution of the entire case is reached. And if a resolution of the entire case was reached, we wouldn't be here. That went up to FERC. FERC denied our complaint. That was the resolution. And unless there are any more questions, I'm going to yield my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take this case under submission.